Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
Unless they came out a story from the Bible.
I tell you to open your mouth.
Let him talk. Don't mean nothing.
I'm not a religious man, you know, but I've read bits and pieces over the years. Curiosity more than faith. About this one story. There was a man. He was traveling from Jerusalem to Jericho when he was set upon by men of ill intent. They stripped the traveler of his clothes. They beat him, and they left him bleeding in the dirt. And the priest happened by, saw the traveler. He moved to the other side of the road and continued on. And then a Levite, a religious functionary, he came to the place, saw the dying traveler. But he too moved to the other side of the road and passed him by. But then came a man from Samaria, Samaritan, a good man. He saw the traveler bleeding in the road, and he stopped to aid him without thinking of the circumstance or the difficulty it might bring him. The Samaritan tended to the traveler's wounds, applying oil and wine. He carried him to an inn, gave him all the money he had, for the owner to take care of the traveler. As the Samaritan, he continued on his journey. He did this simply because the traveler was his neighbor. He loved his city and all the people in it. I always thought that I was the Samaritan in that story. It's funny, isn't it? How even the best of men can be deceived by their true nature.
What the hell does that mean?
It means that I'm not the Samaritan. That I'm not the priest or the Levite. That I am the ill intent who set upon the traveler on a road that he should not have been on.
That's all I'm going to say. So speaking of comics, I'm glad I got to have you guys on.
Look at that winding segue to get us back. Beautifully done.
Can we talk about how garbage Kirkman's scripts are? Let's talk about that for an hour, right? Comics.
I can do this as long as you guys want to.
Gosh, I will go on for hours about comics if that's what we're going to do right now.
But I'm trying to very, very, verily respect JR's time.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, JR. My bad, man. So, I've got to be somewhere too. Wrestling starts now.
Wrestling starts. You can watch it on the WWE channel or whatever.
It's 4 weeks post after.
Did you watch? I don't care.
Did I watch Payback? Yes.
I know you watched Payback. I don't know why I asked. Anyway,
did you watch the pay per view? No, yes, I didn't.
I know you watched the pay per view.
Okay, continue. All right, comics.
So comics, because we're going to talk about Daredevil, and Daredevil not only is something that I think is extraordinary, but it's odd for us to be covering because we have historically not covered many TV shows. And there are, I believe, very few shows that are worth us trying to tackle, you know, in an overarching kind of way.
In one episode and saying, yeah, here's the point. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, we've kind of given an overview with Doctor Who. We've kind of given a look back at The Walking Dead. I think we were three seasons in at the time. We did Game of Thrones, I think four seasons in last year, and all those were really great, but we're always like, oh my gosh, how are we going to fit all this stuff in? And they're deep enough shows that you could probably do something on each episode, and I think Daredevil's no different, but since I don't have a Daredevil only podcast, this is the best we're going to get. But that doesn't mean we're going to skip over anything or that we don't have a plethora of things to talk about, because there are things that run through Daredevil that, you know, extend beyond that just happened in this episode, that just happened in this episode. And before we get to a lot of that stuff, I'm using my hands a lot for some. I'm really.
This is not a video podcast.
I'm really exploring the space
right now. Right now, Mikey is swimming in the room.
I'm like swimming through the Daredevil topics. So the reason that I love that you guys are here, even though we just had you guys on, I love to space people out and kind of mix it up, you know, for the audience. But like JR says, why would we want to give the audience what they want?
Yeah, that just sounds ridiculous to me. Yeah.
I want you guys to not only kind of throw an opening volley about your thoughts about Marvel's Daredevil on Netflix, but kind of give your impression as comic book, I want to say fans, but you guys are here because you're more like comic book gurus, at least relative to most of the other people, well, that I know, much less than most of the people that we have on the show. Give us your impressions of where you think some of the focuses on Matt Murdock or Daredevil are in the comics, and kind of what you saw, how that translated to the show, and if you like some of those changes, or if you think they got it right, because there's obviously something about Daredevil or Matt Murdock, like I said, that people like. He's not Thor, he's not Iron Man, he's not super flashy, but there is something that has made Daredevil an incredibly popular character. So JR, you are on Skype, so as the rules go of Real World Theology, you kind of get to, like I said, you get to not only fire the first volley, but kind of give us your impression of the comic, and then what you came away from the show with.
Yeah, so first of all, I love the show. It's just phenomenal. It's Netflix TV at its finest. It was just great. I can't imagine anyone not enjoying it if you even sort of a little bit like comic booky kind of stuff. And that said, it doesn't even feel that comic booky. It feels for the most part really grounded, and that's partly because Matt Murdock's power set is still super, but it's not, I mean, he's not super strong or anything like that.
It's super just barely.
Yeah, right. And that's, you know, when you think about the character in the comics, for a long time, he was sort of just like the poor man's Spider-Man, right? I mean, he was like basically the same, like he was really agile, he could fight really well, and he's, you know, swung around the city with a baton instead of webbing, and that was it until Frank Miller wrote him, and Frank Miller really explored, like, the tension between, you know, why would a guy who practices law during the day break the law at night as a vigilante, and what would that mean, and kind of grounded him in the street, and so since then he's been just a great character. They've taken him, he's had some weird stuff happen to him over the last few years, the storyline, yeah, the Shadow exactly, but you know, when Shadowland was so in Shadowland, he basically is possessed by a demon. He executes a couple of people, and then when everything gets settled, he decides he can't be there anymore, and he sort of reboots himself. He goes away and comes back, and when he comes back, Mark Waid is writing him and just does a great job with him.
Yeah, and as cool as the Shadowland story sounds, the way that JR puts it, don't read it. Like, don't waste your time. Like, you can read a lot of stuff before Shadowland and then everything after Shadowland, but like Shadowland itself, just avoid anything that you see the guy Diggle, like if his name is on it, don't read it. No offense to him, he's a great writer, like a lot of his stuff, but just avoid it. Continue.
So. Yeah, I mean, anything with Frank Miller you're gonna like. Kevin Smith did a run on Daredevil that was actually really good, mm-hmm. and then all of the times that Mark Waid has written Daredevil have been fantastic because Mark Waid's a genius. Yeah. So,
do you like Bendis's run and Mack and Brubaker and all those guys?
So here's the thing. Honestly, I actually, Daredevil is not one of the comics that I keep up with always.
Yeah, yeah.
So I haven't read those guys' runs. I would assume they're awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I love all of those writers.
So it's great because I think as I think about the comics and the way that it relates to the TV show, probably about, I guess it was almost like 20 years ago now, maybe less than that, maybe like 15. Guy named, by the name of Brian Bendis, who most of you would know if you've watched the credits for the last two Avengers movies, his name is always featured prominently, wrote him, and at the end of his run, him and Brubaker, Ed Brubaker, who's, they're both in Portland, and they're good buddies, and they, at the time, they shared a studio, and he was about to pass it off to Ed Brubaker, and he was like, well, what do you want me to, like, put the pieces back together? Because really, like, a common thing among comic book writers is that if they're going to pass on the story to another writer and they know the other writer is going to take it on for a while, they'll kind of put their toys back in the box. They kind of clean up the mess so that way the new writer has like a clean slate to work with.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, there's a story that goes like in the studio one day, he looks over at Brew, he's like, do you want me to put the pieces back together or make it worse? And Brew was like, give me something to work with. And so he made it way worse. And so you see like throughout all of Bendis's run and then on into Brubaker's run, Daredevil's life gets destroyed. Like people find out who he is. He basically can't be hidden anymore. Like, he can't be just Matt Murdock and then Daredevil. He is the same guy in everyone's mind. And he loses the love of his life because she goes insane. And there's like all these great story elements and great art. Oh my gosh, some of the best art out there. But when you get to Mark Waid, whenever we talk about great art, I mean, you've got guys like Paolo Rivera and Marcos Martin, and oh my gosh, it just gets better and better. And then you get Chris Somney, and I know a lot of these names you guys are hearing, you're like, who? I don't really know that I care. Pretty much all these guys have won awards for being the best artist the year that they were doing a thing. So whenever we say these names, like, they are the best of the best, and working on a book like Daredevil seems surprising for a company like Marvel, who can put any artist they want on any book they want.
That's the weird thing about Daredevil, right? Is like there's no reason when you look at the talent that's been attached to him, and frankly, like what it is about the character, there's no reason he shouldn't be an A-list Marvel person like Spider-Man or Wolverine. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, he always just like stays right under the radar.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I think that's his moveset, his talent set, and I think it's also a little bit of his story. You look at a guy like Wolverine, and he has this really diverse story and comes from a really diverse background, and he's done a lot of things. For the most part, when you look at Murdoch, he's a white guy from New York. And
he doesn't leave very often.
He doesn't leave very often. He's gone right now. Like, in the story he is right now, he had to leave for various reasons. But, like, he doesn't leave very often. And it's kind of like Spider-Man, where as popular as he is, like, Wolverine still has a much bigger fan base. Like, on the whole, just because, you know, he's a very diverse character. But I think it's something about Matt Murdock and Daredevil that is very relatable, of having to be someone who has to sort of hide behind certain things and kind of build walls around yourself to protect those around you because you live in a really dangerous place. And that's the cool part about this show, is that you get to see him build all the walls around himself. But you also get to see him kind of like inch in with different people. And you get to see him like make moves towards the people around him and realize like, oh, you're not all dying. Like, you're not going to die because I tell you that I'm Daredevil. Like, I can protect you. I am capable of doing so. And so I think it's really cool to watch as we get to see that towards the end of the season. And even at the very beginning, you have that Rosario Dawson's character that he, like, meets. And they, you know, they connect. And immediately he kind of, like, shares all these parts of himself with her. And you're like, oh, wow, that's, like, I kind of didn't expect it to be that early in the show where he was, like, sharing who he was with somebody.
Yeah.
But it was great. It was a really, like, there were so many good moments like that. And, I mean, I love the show. I think the show really held true to what the comics have done in the past. I think that it's also not sitting on the same tropes of the Daredevil character in the same ways.
So, as someone, I mean, I've read a little bit of, I don't even know which Waid run, but I read Kevin Smith's run, but that's been like 10 years or something ridiculous like that now. So I am far removed from my comic presence in Daredevil. And I hear both of you guys describing incredible talent working on these comics. And that there still seems to be some kind of mystery, even though you guys are kind of like hinting around there's some really great stories or he does these really cool things. Like, I still haven't heard, like, what is it about his character that, like, I've heard it said that Daredevil is like a comic book fan's superhero. Like, you know, like, if you're just getting into it, I think, JR, you used the phrase, like, Daredevil is not very comic booky, I guess. Mm-mm. You know, like, he's not big and splashy and standing up front with American flags waved behind him like Captain America.
Yeah, so... You know?
So how is he different?
Part of it is purely the fact that he's not so he doesn't have all of the resources that Batman or Iron Man or Captain America have. Like he literally has to make a living. And you get that with Peter Parker, right? It's that part of the where he has to hold down a job, and for Matt Murdock, it's being a lawyer. He runs his own law practice. But by virtue of that fact, like Daredevil has to operate at night. His day job literally limits him to working at night. I think that really plays into it. Like he can't be teaming up with the Avengers. Like he can't just run out of court because he got a Avengers page or whatever, something like that, right? Like he has to do his regular life. He has to be Matt Murdock much more than Iron Man has to be Tony Stark or, you know, Steve Rogers has, or Captain America has to be Steve Rogers, right? Like he has to hold these things down. And I think that's just a good window into who he is. It sort of limits, it puts hard lines around the Daredevil character so that if you tell Griffin, tell me what you think about this, but maybe if you tell a Daredevil story that's not equally a Matt Murdock story, people aren't going to connect to it.
Yeah, and what I was going to say was that I think that Matt Murdock and Daredevil connect with a group of people. I mean, many of us, I would probably say like most of us, who enjoy crime dramas, detective dramas, who enjoy things like that, but also want to see a superhero television show.
Mm-hmm.
Like I always like love his stuff because he's like a better detective than Batman. Like,
don't say that.
He's a better detective than Batman. Mainly because like he doesn't have to, like he's doing it within the realm of the law a lot of the time. So like a lot of his stories, they're so great because like he'll be working on a case in court and he'll like realize like, oh, something weird's going on with this guy. I'm going to like go to his house and like follow him tonight and find out what's happening. And then he goes and like finds out, and then he like brings that back to court and uses that within like the confines of the law, because he can't be like, well, I was like sneak around outside of his house because I'm Daredevil and then I saw him like sleeping with the girl next door, and then, you know, he can't do that. Like he has to like continue to stay within the boundaries of the law. And I think that that's like what attracts most people to that story, is like he has so many great like I think some of his best stories are the ones that really dig into like the detective work that he's doing around the thing, and so he gets really good at it. And as you read his stuff, I think honestly if you're a new person starting out, like right now, if you want to like go pick up something, go pick up the very 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 first trade of Mark Waid's run. We keep talking about this guy. He first off, one of the best storytellers, and the reason I say that is because great comic writers are able to catch you up in the story without smacking you across the face with who the character is every single time. Like every single time, he doesn't tell you that Amazing Spider, like that Spider-Man was bitten by a radioactive spider. Like you don't have to hear that every single issue. But Mark Waid has this amazing ability to catch you up. Here's Matt Murdock. Here's Daredevil. Here's their talent set, and here's the story so far, without saying Daredevil killed like or blinded by radioactive, like he doesn't have to do that.
And so obviously Mark Waid's not been the one writing the Spider-Man movies.
No,
that's accurate. Yeah,
that's very accurate. Yeah, so like whenever I think of like the best writers in comics, my bar none favorite whenever it comes to script and story, like can combine both of those things because they're both really important. A lot of great story writers aren't great script writers, like that's just a fact.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever it comes to like combining the two, Mark Waid is very brief, but is very, oh man, he is the best whenever it comes to like plotting out a story. And I think that the art around his series, his entire series, has been grade A, like better than most Marvel comics and most comics out there, honestly.
So to kind of piggyback on a point that you were making before your Mark Waid love.
Yes, sorry.
Which I think is well deserved.
Yeah, sorry.
One of the things that when someone comes to me, and like I said, I know about comic stuff, but yeah. I would never, like, obviously I have you guys on here, so I don't need to know about all the things, but compared to the average person, I have decent amount of comic and superhero knowledge, and people would say, which is better, DC or Marvel? And I'm like, saying better Marvel is a very hard thing.
Marvel.
But,
DC. I mean.
See? So, I typically tell people that I feel Marvel has caught on more because Marvel has humanized their character, their superheroes, better than DC has, yes. Barring Batman. And because of that connection,
don't worry, they're ruining that too.
Yeah, I'm sure. I mean, that's the sad part. So the only good thing they had going was Batman, as far as like humanizing him and giving the audience something they could connect to. Meanwhile, Marvel's making like Iron Man, and it's mostly Tony Stark. And then they give you Tony Stark before they give you Iron Man, and they give you Steve Rogers before they give you Captain America, and so Marvel has like the humans that are also super, and DC just has these invincible super people that are hard to relate right. to. So right. in the Marvel universe, the most human super seems to be, well, not the most of everyone, but of the ones that we've at least gotten so far from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, seems to be Daredevil. Like, he skews way more human than super.
Yeah.
And so the thing that we connect with the Marvel Universe the most, that humanity, we get the most of in Daredevil. And that, to me, is in and of itself why it seems like this show is so popular. I have not seen anyone... you guys can correct me if you have naysayers in your friend circles, but I have not had anyone watch this series and not like it.
Yeah.
And not only like it, but like people are like, this is great. Have you seen it? How could you not binge this?
Yeah, and in fact, I mean, quite the opposite. I haven't seen anyone hate it. I've seen people who had only like a passing interest in it at best, mm-hmm. or have said things like, well, you know, I love Orange is the New Black, I like House of Cards, whatever, like, I guess I'll give this one a chance. People who just like didn't really care, and then they get two episodes in and they can't quit watching, you know. So,
well, and that says something about, so it's 13 episodes, all get, you know, Netflix, so it's all out at once.
Yeah,
you know, we have the creator Drew Goddard, who has at least in some partial way given us Cabin in the Woods, so he's already used to turning things that we're used to seeing kind of on their head. And if you haven't seen Cabin in the Woods, I would recommend you watching Cabin in the Woods and then listening to our episode on it, because it's a great episode. But like, how does this differ from other popular shows? I mean, we've already talked DC versus Marvel, but we have Arrow, we have Flash.
But let's look at,
why is this different?
Look at when you look at those shows, my biggest gripe and biggest reason that I don't watch Arrow, I don't watch Flash, I don't really watch S.H.I.E.L.D., I kind of catch up from time to time, is because these shows have the same mindset every episode. Here you have the hero and the villain of the week. And it seems like every episode tends to do that kind of routine. And I think that that's the same reason that shows like Law and Order and, you know, CSI, as great as like big as their fan base is, and as long as these shows are able to go, it doesn't really attract a lot of like critical love and affection, because it's very easy to plot that out. When you look at what Daredevil has done, they've said, hey, we got one villain.
Seven
villains, but the whole point of this show is like digging in on Fisk, and you have little moments of like, Stick shows up, Owl is kind of there. What is that? Yeah. Can we that's kind of weird. I'm not even gonna get into that. He's kind of there and never turns into the Owl. Maybe next season, I don't know.
But no, we can't get into that.
Yeah, I know we can't. It's a waste of time to get into that. It's over. But like, when you talk about this show, it is a character piece on Matt Murdock. It's a character piece on Wilson Fisk. And it is like a picture of how these two are foils of one another. How they're both after the same goal,
mm-hmm.
but going about it completely different ways.
Well, then I'll ask this question to JR based on that. It's something I was going to... I thought we would end up getting to much later in the show, but... JR, is Wilson Fisk, or the Kingpin, the best villain in the Marvel Cinematic Universe right now?
I mean, that's not even a fair question. Like, name someone who's even close. Loki, maybe. Like, one thing Marvel doesn't do well is villains. They create one-dimensional cardboard cutouts that they kill at the end of each movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, Fisk is phenomenal.
So this is what I want to get us away from as much as I can. Because we love this show so much, I feel like amazing, phenomenal, the best, things like that are what we're going to keep using. So yep. Why is Wilson Fisk as a villain phenomenal?
Well, it's like what Griffin already said, right? Typically in the comics, Fisk is relatively one-dimensional. He's just like the ultimate mob boss. And in this show, they did a really good job of humanizing him, making you have empathy for him. I'm rewatching the show right now with my wife, Amanda, and we just finished the episode last night where Fisk decapitates one of the Russian brothers with the car. And like when that scene was over, she was just like, oh, what?
Did that happen?
Yeah, it's all right. Like, you know, you'd seen the scenes with him and his girl in the museum and like are in the art gallery, and there's all, and you're like, all right, like he's a pretty good, and then you're, and then that happens, you're like, never mind. Like, so you get what I think what works about him is you have Matt Murdock, who's trying to figure out if maybe he might be the devil, right? He tells that story at the very beginning where he's telling the priest that his grandma would always say those fists or those Murdock boys have the devil in them.
Mm-hmm.
And he's worried that this thing he's decided to do is proof that he has the devil in him. And Fisk's story is the exact opposite. It's a devil who's convinced that he's good. And by the end of the story, both of those guys have figured out who they really are.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, how does this story really set up them as foils? And I wanted to kind of go back to their childhood.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because actually I had a really interesting conversation with Gene from Let There Be Movies, and he was like, I couldn't stop thinking about this concept of like what happens to us as child, like as children, and like how we let that affect us for the rest of our life. And you know, he pointed to the story of Joshua in Genesis, and he's like, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. And talking about how bad things happen to, you know, well, I don't say to good people, bad things just happen. And like, do we in that use that or try to let that be a force for good, or do we assume there's something behind it that's driving it?
Yeah, the thing that's hard, I kind of wish that I had gone into this show. Like, I kind of wish that this show, I had never met Daredevil before and didn't know who Wilson Fisk was.
So you weren't sure who was the good guy and who was the bad guy?
Yeah, like, because I think the show does such a great job of setting it up as, like, I'm not sure. You know, I'm not entirely certain that Wilson Fisk is a bad guy. It seems like he has a temper, and it seems like that he has, like, I mean, he's running a mob and he's running, you know, an illegal business, but that doesn't entirely make him bad. I've watched The Wire enough to know that like being a part of a legal business doesn't make you a bad guy, you know? And so I think if there's anything The Wire taught me, it's like being a part of like a legal business doesn't make you a bad guy. But I think that the show really sets that up so well of putting them against each other, making you look at both of them and say, like, If you're taking it not as, like, you know that this guy's going to end up being the good guy, Daredevil, and Wilson is going to end up being the bad guy because the show is called Daredevil, and, you know, no one wants to watch a show about a villain, right? I think, no. People do want to watch a show about a villain.
All the time.
And that's the thing that I think this show does so well, because it makes it a show about a villain instead of making it a show about, like, this hero's struggle and this hero's strife. It makes it a show about, Is part of Matt Murdock villainous? Is the part of him that wants to, like, kill another person, dispense final justice on, you know, other people, does that make him a villain? And is the fact that Wilson Fisk is willing to kill to make his city safer, does that make, and not even safer, because it's not safe, I don't think that's what he's looking for, but to make his city a better place, is the fact that he's willing to kill as well to do the same thing that Matt Murdock's willing to do, does that make him a bad guy? And I don't think so until you get to the point where he's willing to kill no matter whether it makes the city better or not.
Okay, so I feel like somewhere in there, in both their progressions, they have to make a choice. Like, bad stuff happens to Matt Murdock as a child. right?
Yeah.
All right, bad stuff happens to Wilson Fisk as a child.
Yeah.
But something happens to them. Big hand motions again, right?
Clearly.
Something happens to them along their path that says a choice needs to be made. Like, what are you going to do? Like, how are you going to take this pain? And how is that going to affect how you move out from their own?
Well, I think that you have a moment in the show, and I think that it's clear. I think you have the moment in the show where Wilson is separated from his lady, and you have that same, in that same kind of like timeline, Matt Murdock is receiving like comfort and affection from the people who were around him, saying like, hey, we're still on your side. You know, Foggy is saying like, hey man, I know that you're doing this thing because it's the right thing to do, even though I don't agree with it. I think that you have that moment where one person who's had a lot of bad happen to him is getting comfort from those around him and telling him, people are telling him like, it's going to be like, we're still going to be here. We're still Nelson and Murdoch. That's not changing. And on the other side, you're having this character who's had a lot of bad happen to him get more bad added to his plate. And so his response is understandable.
Well, I felt there was a big part where, even though it's kind of menacing and we don't understand the whole story, which is actually very cool that we don't understand the story, like at some point in his childhood, like Wilson Fisk has like basically no one that comes alongside him.
Yeah.
Yep. Stick comes alongside, like I said, for good or bad.
An insane old blind guy.
Old blind guy. If nothing else, if he doesn't get him to fully jump on his insane blind guy plan, whatever that plan kind of is that we're not entirely sure about, he basically disciples Matt Murdock and says, like, you know, boy Matt Murdock, and says, you're not, you know, dying. This doesn't make you weird. This makes you exceptional. And then teaches him and trains him up in the ways and kind of sort of ends up sending him into the world, even though, again, he's a terrible father figure. But there's something there that, like, affirms his pain and then kind of redirects it, as opposed to Fisk, who just has pain and looks at a wall.
Fisk was sent off. Remember, he tells his girlfriend, whose name I can never remember, that his mother sent him off to live with family on a farm, and as we can assume that was after he straight up executes his dad.
Her name is Vanessa. I forgot.
Vanessa, thank you. Yeah. So he tells her that. So I don't know. Like, I think he specifically says that those were good times for him.
Because he didn't kill anybody? I mean, like, that's pretty...
I mean, he was out of the city and with people that protected him. I mean, I don't know. He didn't say why.
Yeah.
He just...
Well, that's what I'm saying. We don't really know.
I think it's important that both of their fathers were violent men.
Mm-hmm.
But Matt's dad, especially because the whole show is this question of, is vigilantism okay or not? Is the sort of violence that Matt is enacting upon the people of Hell's Kitchen fundamentally different from Fisk's? I mean, that's a big question in the show.
Yeah.
And you have Matt, whose father's violence was oriented in a socially acceptable way. And he's a boxer, right? Fisk's father's was not. Fisk's father's violence was in socially unacceptable ways, which was specifically, you know, spouse and child abuse.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, the show never really develops that, but it's interesting to me that from the beginning in their childhoods, like you said, that's a big difference, is that both of them are products of violent men, but one man's violence was channeled appropriately and one's wasn't. And the one whose father's violence was not channeled appropriately grows up to be a person of evil, you know, of wrong violence.
But arguably, though, another difference that you could say about these two characters is that, regardless of whether he says it or not, Matt Murdock realizes that he's exceptional. He knows he's exceptional. He knows he's talented and skillful and has these abilities, yep, that no one else has.
Sure.
Wilson Fisk doesn't know that he's exceptional. Vanessa's the first person that, like, looks at him and says, like, you're worthwhile. Like, I'm willing to, like, break a little bit, a couple of my rules to be with you. Because she kind of, at the beginning, she comes off as, I know, like, kind of, I know what you are, but I don't know what you are. She, you know, she has to ask a lot of times, but she's not dumb.
And she's a smart lady.
Yeah, she doesn't come across as dumb at all. So she knows this guy is not a good guy. But at the same time, she's like, I'm willing to break my rules to be with you because I think that you are exceptional. And it's the first person that's ever told him that, whereas Murdoch was told that as soon as, like, right after all this stuff happens, where he becomes this kind of, like, freak. And
well, and even before that, right? I mean, we get the sense that his relationship with his father
was great.
It's just a very good relationship.
Or as good as it could have been, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, I think it's as good as it could have been. And I think the comics really develop it into a really good relationship. But definitely as good as it could have been. And when you look at what, you know, he's told, like, you're good. And you're loved and you're cared about. And even Stick, even though he leaves, still cares about Daredevil in a very, like, weird way, in a very, like, I don't know, it's
he kept the bracelet, you guys.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's how you know. but you know, so he's told he's exceptional. He knows he's exceptional all of his life. He knows he has abilities. He's very smart, very skilled, very quick-witted, whereas, like, Fisk is not really anything powerful.
Oh, but if he was any of those things, he apparently didn't have anyone come along and tell him.
Yeah, no one acknowledged that in him.
Yeah, whereas, like I said, for all the flaws that Stick has, at least Stick was like, look, you're special and awesome. Let's go kick some butt.
Yeah.
You know, and then that gave him the confidence to, you know, hone more of his other things, like his man whoring and things like that. So, you don't agree with his man whoring?
Well, I think it's interesting too, you know, because I've been trying to tease out how the show decides that what Matt does is good and what Fisk does is bad. They both work outside the law explicitly, and one of the things I think that is interesting is that Matt's concern for the city is always very specific and, if I can steal the word, incarnated. It's always about Karen or Foggy or Mrs. Cardenas, right? Like, there's always specific people, and if he's taking on a case or fighting someone or doing something, there's always, like, a person at the end of that, very specifically.
Yeah.
With Fisk, I was never able to understand how he thought what he was doing was good for the city. I never understood. I don't know. I just never understood that. It never had his plans. Never had a face to them.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was gonna say the thing that the one piece that he gave me that actually made sense about what his character was trying to do. It didn't really make me understand why he had such kind of a love for that city, but when he's talking to Vanessa and he basically is giving this this metaphor for death and resurrection, and he says, you know, this city needs to basically be reborn. So before we can build it up, it has to be torn down. It has to basically be destroyed before it can basically. So it has to, you know, it has to destroy it. You know, it has to be destroyed before it can be reborn. And I'm like, man, Fisk gets death and resurrection. He's all over it.
So he's basically the League of Shadows.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it's like. He's like, I understand that in how the world works, before something can rise, it has to basically be. All the pieces of what it was have to be destroyed.
Because he uses the Phoenix metaphor, right? Does he use that, or am I thinking of another television show I've watched recently?
I don't remember. He might have used the Phoenix.
I feel like he talks about the Phoenix at some point in there.
But I mean, that's the general gist of what he's saying. He realizes that the old city can no longer coexist with where he wants to take the city.
Yeah.
So he has to let the old city completely die. And I was like, like I said, I was like, wow, I can't believe he totally was on top of that. Because it's something that I think, you know, we can relate to, at least theologically. You can't bring a little piece of the old bad part with you into the new part.
Mm-hmm.
Not to be a new creation, not to be a new city, not to be a new Hell's Kitchen, or maybe a Heaven's Kitchen when he's done rebuilding it. Who knows?
Hey-o.
But so all this... And I think you kind of hit on their motivations, because I was wondering, like, what are their motivations, and are they really that different because they are foils?
Well, no, I mean, that's the whole point of them being foils, right? They want the same thing. They just fundamentally disagree about what it will take to achieve that end, right? Fisk says it has to be destroyed. Matt says no. We can work for justice and equality and flourishing with what we have here now.
Definitely. So, when they, I think JR, you pointed this out a little bit earlier. When you kind of say like they have their realizations at the end of them trying to figure out like who they are, and I don't have a good segue into this, so I almost want to just kind of throw it up into the air and say, who wants to tackle any aspect of Fisk's Good Samaritan story first?
Go for it, Griffin. I mean, it was amazing.
On the nose.
I literally said, not it.
No, I mean, I'll go, but no, please.
Yeah. Gosh.
Okay, so I can do this. I can do this like I did JR earlier.
Yeah, okay. So,
best supervillain speech ever?
Okay, no. Okay, so just to remind listeners, if you haven't watched the show recently...
Are you going to play a clip of it in here,
Mike? I'm not going to...
I wonder if I could.
Yeah, but so basically... Fisk tells the story of the Good Samaritan. He's talking to Vanessa. And
he's not talking to Vanessa.
Who's he talking
to? No, he's in the police wagon.
Oh, is he talking to the cop?
Yeah.
I forget that he's talking
like
to the
two guys
cop.
In the wagon
That's
with
right.
Them.
That's right. That's okay. So he's telling them the story, and then he gets to the end of it, and he kind of basically is like, I always thought I was the Good Samaritan, but now I realize like I'm the guy, not the guy, not only the guys who walked by, I'm the guy who beat up.
I am the man of ill intent.
Yeah, the man of ill intent. I'm the villain.
Yeah.
And so, man, I think that as like monologues go, this is, I mean, for a villain movie, for a villain show, like whenever you think about things that villains have said, gosh, I feel like that he gets to the heart of what the story behind so many great villains are, is that they think that they're doing right. They think that they're doing well. They think that they're doing good, when really they are the man of ill intent. Mm-hmm. And he really, like, I think that it sets up so much greatness in the show. That's why we keep talking about it this way, is because the show doesn't smack you across the face with the fact that, like, we've talked about it over and over again, that you don't know whether they're good or bad, like whether he's good or bad at this point. And you do, but you don't. And
well, because you can be misguided.
Yeah.
And not be what we would typically classify as evil.
As evil, yeah. Evil. And yeah, you could go back to, you know, being... I keep thinking about the... I love, if you haven't seen it, you should. The Mad Max turn of, like, the kind of evil... Like, the bad... Like, the character at the beginning who's, like, you know, strings Mad Max up on the front of his car and is like, I'm the bad guy. And then he, like, turns into the good guy. And you're like, why did he turn into the... Oh, a girl. That's why. That makes
spoilers.
Perfect sense. A girl.
I mean, it's a little more complicated than that, but this is not a Mad Max podcast.
Yes, I get that. But it makes me think of things like that, where you have these turns that happen inside of movies, inside of television shows. And I think that what you see here is a great turn of a character who's sitting there realizing, like, I'm not as good as I thought I was. I'm also probably... as bad as everyone is calling me, as the newspapers and as Matt Murdock and all these other people are calling me. I'm as bad as all of them are saying, if not worse.
So with that, I think the thing that struck me most about that speech is when he says, like, I am the ill intent, basically, he furthers it and add something that is not in the story. I'm the ill intent that basically, like, comes down upon the traveler who is like on a road that he should have never been on in the first place. And that to me, that to me kind of brought the story full circle, because I was like, what, you just realize you're a bad guy? But it still to me connects his motives with what he's been doing the whole time. He is basically trying to, again, say basically all the time, he is still
essentially
trying to punish those who were not on the correct path. So I wonder if he would still, like, I'm guessing he still sees his role as necessary.
So I guess I read that scene differently. I thought the ill intent was that came on the bandits, not on the guy who was on the wrong path. Was he on the wrong path?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think
in that moment that he's talking exclusively about this story. I think that he's pointing towards... Right. I think he's pointing at the city and saying, like, the reason that I'm doing this is because you should have never been here in the first place.
Yeah.
I'm coming upon you with ill intent, with destruction on my mind, because you should have never come to this point. You should have never been in that residence. You should have never lived here. This residence should have... I mean, I keep thinking about the Miss Cardenas story, because I feel like it takes up so much of the space of the show. Like, there's so much... Foggy's focused on it, Karen's focused on it, Matt's focused on it, and it really, to them, this one lady's story really matters. And I think that when you look at the bigger picture of what Fisk is saying, he's like, she should have never been there, because that place should have never been the way that, like, it should have never been low-income housing.
Yeah.
Not to point out, like, not to be, it's not a social commentary on, like, low-income housing. I don't think the show is at all talking about that. I think it's more just saying, this city should have never looked this way.
Well, and so that's why when I heard Fisk at the end of his speech throw in the, you know, to the traveler basically who is on the path that he should have never been on, or that, you know, he should have avoided, or I can't remember exactly how he phrased it. Hopefully if I'm lucky, I'll be able to splice that speech in here. But
and then all of our listeners will know better than we do.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't believe they talked about that.
And I'm fine with that.
Miss this major point.
But what it does is, to me, that whole death and resurrection theme is him going back to it. Because I feel like he was essentially being dishonest with himself. Because he said that the city needed to destroy itself before it could be rebuilt new, and the way it was supposed to be, the way it was meant to be. But he was also thinking that I'm the Good Samaritan. I can take the thing that's broken and I can pay for it to get better. I can give it help, and I can nurse this broken thing back to health. But I think when he realizes that he's the ill intent, he goes back to his first speech with Vanessa, where he says, the old can't exist. The traveler should have never been on this road, and basically no mercy, no quarter for the traveler, no mercy, no quarter for the city. If anything is not on the plan of going ahead, it is going to get the ill intent. And I understand who I am now, and I understand my conflicting philosophies, and I'm moving forward in that knowledge. And he becomes the Kingpin.
Hmm.
Does that jive, JR?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, I really thought that he was saying he was the ill intent of the men who set upon the innocent person.
So I'm just gonna read. It's not too long. Right after, but he tells the story of the Good Samaritan. If you haven't read it, you should, and come back to us. And so he sighs deeply. He says, "I always thought that I was the Samaritan in that story. It's funny, isn't it? How even the best of men can be deceived by their true nature." And then the cop asks, what does that even mean? Or he says, what the hell does that mean? And he says, it means that I'm not the Samaritan, that I'm not the priest or the Levite, that I am the ill intent who set upon the traveler on a road that he should not have been on.
So there, I mean, that the bit that's important to me in there is that he says even the best men can be deceived by their true nature.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that he's sort of saying, in this whole thing, I've realized I'm not the savior. I'm not the good guy. Like, I'm the ill intent.
And that he's not even the guys who even pass passing by right, on the other side of the road. Like he's not even a neutral character. He is definitively the bad guy. He says it in such a way that's not saying like, and it doesn't say, "Hey, I'm the bad guy." I don't know if you realize this, which so many, I think that's the great thing about, like whenever we talk about great movies that talk like that deal with this essence of good and bad, it's not whenever so much that the lines are blurred. It's so much that the people who are writing the movie don't assume that you're stupid as movie watchers and as TV watchers. And this show doesn't assume stupidity on the part of those watching it. It assumes that you're going to catch the hints, that you're going to catch all the bits, and that whenever he says things like this, whenever there's this huge monologue about the Good Samaritan, you're going to be like, "Oh, that's great." And I think that's where we like whenever we look at, you know, you were talking about earlier, like why we try to avoid. We know it's good, but why is it good? Shows and movies that don't assume stupidity, that assume that you know what we're talking about whenever we talk about this thing, whenever we make a sly joke, that you as the watcher, as the listener, if you don't know automatically, you're going to go find out. You're going to take the moment to like go look it up, and that's okay. And I think that's what this show does so well, is it doesn't assume we don't know what's going on.
Yeah, and so for me, I think what was important to me at the end of the show, end of first season, is that Fisk has realized that he is the devil of Hell's Kitchen, and that Matt has realized that he is a hero.
So what does that mean for Fisk's character, though? So, like, the way that you see him come to that realization, JR, what is his goal now?
I don't think his goal has changed, actually. Okay. I think he's just now honest about what that means. Because what it has meant is that he's saving the city.
So when you say what that means, are you talking about that means it's going to affect his methods? Or because you're saying it's not affecting his goals. His goals.
He's been telling everyone the whole show, "I'm saving the city, I'm saving the city, I'm saving the city, I'm saving the city."
Mm-hmm.
Right? And that's what he says in the Samaritan thing. He's like, I used to think I was the Samaritan. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And now he's like, "No, I'm not. I'm the ill intent." So I think we're going to see him basically double down on everything.
Okay.
Like he's going to become the kingpin of crime. Whereas before, I don't know if it was something like, you know, why was he eliminating all of these people? And he was telling himself it's because they're hurting the city and what he's going to do is actually helping it. Or like he had somehow convinced himself that it was going to be different, that he was going to be different, that he was helping. And now what he's saying is like, "I'm not helping." Does that make sense?
Well, it does, up until the part where I'm like, so his goal is to still help the city. So you're saying that he's acknowledging that he's not helping, but he's also trying to help the city.
No, I'm saying he's acknowledging that he was never helping the city.
Okay.
That was never, he was blinded to his true nature.
Okay.
That he is a man of violence, just like his father, that all he does is destroy things. And so he's going to embrace that.
Okay, so his goal is no longer to save the city.
I don't think his goal was ever to save the city. Well, I think that's what he told himself.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then, that makes sense. I that's where I was misunderstanding you, because I was thinking that you were saying his goal was still the same, which, I mean, we're saying now in retrospect, yes, his goal was always the same. He just didn't recognize his goal.
Right, yeah, I think his arc in this series has been self-revelation. Like, he now understands who he is.
So, mainly because I want to try to get to as much as we can. So, when we ask people, you know, what kind of themes or what kind of theology or faith aspects do you see in this film, I think the Good Samaritan parable is actually not the most theologically deep thing that we see, but it's the most obvious, right? So like most other things, someone says this is in the Bible and everyone's like, that's the thing that's about Jesus, or that's the thing that's about the Bible in that show. And while the Good Samaritan parable in Wilson Fisk's or Vincent D'Onofrio's capable hands was incredible, because of all the reasons we just talked about, I think lots of the theology or lots of the rub with Matt Murdock as a character comes with his interactions with the priest.
Mm-hmm.
And this can, I mean, I don't necessarily want to dwell on it too long, but I don't know if either of you guys want to kind of specifically talk about what Matt Murdock's relationship with the Catholic Church is like in the comics, and how does that similarly come out here, or is that different? Is it more intense in the comics and we're just getting a smidgen of it in the show, or vice versa?
Well, it always depends in the comics on who's writing.
Okay.
Right? I mean, that's, his religiosity is something that's relatively easy to ignore. You know, draw him on top of a Gothic church every now and again, you paid your lip service. But when he's in capable hands, it is his Catholicism really provides a lot of resonance for the character, because you know you have the stereotypical jokes about the Catholic guilt complex, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, I'm never doing enough, I'm always failing, blah blah blah, and they play into that. But even that fundamental tension of I'm doing something wrong to do something right is a wonderful thing for, you know, do the ends justify the means? Is violence okay as long as they don't kill people? Right, like those are all in some ways religious questions, and Daredevil is a great lens to explore those characters through. Griffin, what do you think of it?
Well, I feel like when you look at the comics, the thing that I kept looking back towards was, like, one of the first people to write him. I think it may have been the first person to write him that way was Miller in Born Again with Mazzucchelli. Right? Was that Mazzucchelli who was drawing on that?
It's very important.
It's not important. Actually, Mazzucchelli, if it was Mazzucchelli, you should read it. It is a good story, but it basically, the whole book is about this idea of him dealing with all these aspects of himself that are at odds. So, you know, the whole the biggest thing that I think when you look at comics and these shows is that, for the most part, final justice, death is not going to be dispensed at the hands of the heroes, unless you're watching a Punisher show. And God, I wish that would happen again. Gosh, did you guys watch that short from like 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Actually,
so good.
Mainly because I haven't read a ton of Daredevil. Uh-huh. My current favorite Daredevil story is the one where he shows up in Garth Ennis's Punisher run.
Uh-huh.
And Punisher is going to kill like a mob boss, and Matt Murdock's like, you can't kill him.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we've got to do the justice lawyer
thing.
And Punisher basically gets in a fight with Daredevil, and Daredevil starts kicking his butt. But, you know, Punisher's got something up his sleeve. Ends up getting the upper hand on Daredevil. And then I think ties Daredevil up, gives him a gun. And when Daredevil wakes up, it's like a duct tape gun to his hand, and he's pointing at Punisher. And Punisher's getting ready to assassinate the guy. And he's like, you're going to either have to kill me or I'm going to kill him. And the Daredevil has to make that choice. And I was like, this is mind-blowingly awesome. Because you have Daredevil like having to make the choice that he never wants to have to make, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, for various reasons.
Someone has to die. Who's it going to be?
Yeah.
And I think that's the question that gets brought up so much in Daredevil stories. It's like, someone's going to have to pay for this. Mm-hmm. Are you going to be the one to pay for this? Is your friend going to be the one to pay for this? Or is the villain going to be the one to pay for this?
But that's,
and
what
it it's not always like final justice, but a lot of times it is, someone's going to have to pay.
But that's what we get into with the priest, right?
Yeah.
The priest even says there's like, you know, like there's this huge wide gulf between
Inaction
and murder.
Yeah.
We'll pretend I knew that off the top of my head. And
classic pacifist argument, by the way.
Yep.
That's one of my big pet peeves, when people are like, oh, well, so you just like roll over and take it? Yep. Those are the only two options. You either murder him to death or you roll over and take it. That's it. It's totally binary.
Oh. Well, it's actually, there was a great article from on Pathos. Talking about a writer saying that he was not happy with the imagination of Daredevil, even though he loved the show, and because he's pointing back to a book that says only forgiveness will break cycles of violence that enslave us, and that all cycles of violence or the ingredients to forgiveness are memory, empathy, and imagination. And it's this really cool concept that says you have to be able to remember, like, that what happened to you and be able to empathize the fact that it's not just you that's hurting and that other people are people, and then having the imagination to understand another way to deal with the situation besides redemptive violence.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, the attempt at redemptive violence. And so I'll make sure I link that in the show notes, but that gets into, like I said, the entire conversations that we have the priest, you know?
That's also where you go, well, sure, but we are watching a comic book show, and if Daredevil never punched anyone...
Well, but see, that's the cool thing. I mean, you can be full-on, you know, full-on pacifist. But as far as, like, the Catholic backdrop of this, it's not real, you know, the ire isn't so much with punching guys or even, you know, breaking bones and stuff like that. It's with the ultimate thou shalt not kill. And that's where we get kind of that infusion.
Right.
And the priest keeps coming back to, you know, like, Matt Murdock's like, hey, how do I deal with the devil? How do I deal with the devil? Is the devil real? He looks real. You know,
what if I can kill him, right? What if I can kill the devil? Yeah.
Is that okay? And basically, Matt Murdock asks that, I want to say straw man kind of argument, which we kind of already addressed, in a different form. Because, you know, like when someone says, you know, I don't believe we should kill somebody, and they kind of come from like a Christian, like either pacifist or anti-killing, you know, because it's in the Bible kind of stance, that they say, okay, well, someone breaks into your house. And they're gonna
start raping everybody.
Yeah, they're raping everybody. You know,
hide your kids, hide your wife.
Exactly. And then they're gonna start shooting everybody.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
People who break into your house do.
You're just gonna roll over and take it.
Yeah, and so you know we get this great story from the priest who basically was like, you know, I'm a really smart guy. I'm not a stereotype. I'm not someone just a sounding board. I'm actually like a three-dimensional priest. And
you stop it. We don't have those on TV.
We didn't technically have it on TV. We had it on Netflix. So
it was on my TV.
It was on my TV. So, you know, we had this guy who's like, I went to seminary. I thought it was hogwash. And let me explain all these reasons why I think the devil is just a metaphor. But real life happened. I went and this awful, awful, awful thing happened. And now I believe the devil walks among us. And so then Matt Murdock basically throws the, all right, so that warlord is in your house. He's raping all your kids. He's raping all your family. And he's shooting, you know, he's doing everything. Do you kill him? And that's when we get like the, there's a wide, gaping, you know, huge river, sea, ocean, whatever. I'm doing hands again. You can't see me doing hands, but Griffin's enjoying the hands.
Oh, motions. I can hear it. I can hear him.
You keep like the wind keeps knocking.
Yeah, it's like whoosh. You know, but between inaction and, you know, and murder.
Well, and that's where the Catholic backdrop serves him really well, because in the Catholic backdrop is the just war tradition, which when it's practiced rightly, still says murder is always, always, always the last mm-hmm. option, you know. And so even excluding the pacifist argument, because we're watching a comic book show and we know that's just not going to be an option. No one reads a pacifist comic superhero, right? I mean, this idea of just war, that's like you do whatever you have to protect the innocent, but you're also sort of trying to fight on behalf of the villain as well. Again, relative to the fact that we're watching a comic book show, you know, I think that's kind of what we saw in the end, is where he embraces his ability to enact violence, but he embraces it on behalf of those who are oppressed and lashes out against the oppressor to great effect.
Well, it was interesting to see that until he maybe comes to the realization that killing the devil isn't actually going to either be worth it or really fix the problem. When he's on that other path, what is it, like episode 9 or something?
Yeah.
Like he decides, I'm going to go to hell because one person going to hell is worth killing the devil.
Yeah.
That's when like life starts completely unraveling for him. When he chooses a thing that he knows he's not supposed to be doing.
Yeah. And I mean, literally, he nearly dies for it, right?
Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for him, his mantra and stuff, he probably would have.
His mantra.
I don't know what he's doing. Well, that was the thing, you know, because he had that bit of, like, I meditate, you know, to kind of have his, like, sub-Wolverine powers.
Well, it's not sub-Wolverine powers. He actually just believes, I think, that, like, meditation will heal me quicker than just living.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Sub-Wolverine. You know, he's channeling his Chia pet. I don't know what he's doing. He's sitting there. He's going out and punching people pretty often. That's all I know.
Yeah.
After having broken ribs and the such.
Yeah. Like, can we talk about that hallway fight scene?
He's going to ask me what my favorite thing in a minute is.
I assume we're going
to
get the favorite.
But don't I get to go first because I'm on Skype?
No, I'm getting to go first because I already shoddy. I called it. That's it. Mine. You can do whatever. You can talk about whatever you want. My favorite thing before we even get there is the hallway fight scene. Done. If he says it, he's just copying me.
All right. So Griffin just called shotgun on our favorite moments scene.
And I just rolled over and took it.
Rolled over and took it because, you know, what else are you going to murder me about it?
Yeah, I'm not willing to murder you to death over that hallway fight scene.
God, and those are my only two options. There's so many other things you could have done, JR, but...
Nope, that's it. I live in a binary world.
So is there anything else, that Griffin, that you want to add about, like, the kind of Catholic influence or his relationship with the priest? Like, did that work for you?
Well, but... So the thing about Murdoch and it's almost the same thing as, like, Spider-Man, whenever he is doing all of this to some extent because he feels bad about his father's death.
Mm-hmm.
He's getting back at the mob and the mafia and these people who are the organized crime in the city because of his father's death still. He's paying for that even whenever, as a child, he had no way he could stop it. There was nothing he could do about that happening other than not tell his dad to win. You know, that's the only thing that he could have...
If his dad just hadn't wanted Matt to be proud of him...
Yeah.
None of this would have happened.
Yeah.
So really,
exactly. And if Matt just hadn't have, like, wanted to be proud of his... You know, if Matt was just proud of his dad no matter what, you know, geez. If Matt was just a little bit more forgiving...
Yeah.
...as a small child...
So are we alluding to, like, some kind of Catholic guilt here that he's...
I mean...
You know, it's interesting, Griffin, because I didn't... I mean, I know that that's a lot stronger in the comics. I didn't really take that away as much in the show.
They kept flashing back to it. That's why I took it away. Like,
yeah, I mean,
somebody was flashing back to that scene. Like, somebody in their mind. Like, whenever I see those things, I'm like, whether they flash back to, like, Matt Murdock sitting there, like, sweat dripping down his, you know, it's like, I'm assuming that Matt is the one flashing back to that scene.
Sure.
So I guess I
read it as more general, like, he's the same reason he practices law, right? Like, he wants people to be flourishing and safe.
He wants to overthrow the organized crime.
I mean, I think that's a means to an end.
Yeah.
So I think his ultimate goal is more generally that people would have the freedom to flourish in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
Okay, so as we start to transition to wrapping this up in the next half hour.
Sometime in the next day.
JR did throw out kind of like the, hey, we're recording on Daredevil. What do y'all want to hear us talk about? And I neglected to write down specifically who was asking what, which I typically am very good at doing. But, so there's going to be two reactions from you guys. One, there were a number of inquiries about what we thought about the suit. So, JR, what did you think about the suit?
I thought it was well worth the wait. And I liked it. I liked how Fisk had this sort of, like, armor, and then they revealed that was why he got the suit. I mean, I hurt every time he was with the Night Nurse and she was dressing his wounds. Mm-hmm. I was like, ugh. Gosh, she's like, you probably should, like, wear some body armor. He's like, I can't. I thought they set that all up really well, and it wasn't actually to protect the innocents or any of that kind of stuff. Like, I mean, it was much more for himself, frankly, because he already had the mask. You know, I liked it. It worked for me. I didn't think it looked silly once he finally revealed it. So
I remember you talked about the mask. I'm pretty sure it was Laura when we finally got to his suit. she was like, I think his suit's kind of cool, but I kind of miss him going around the city kicking people's butts as the Dread Pirate Roberts.
I know, right?
that was my thing, is I love the early outfit. And so when they introduced the newer armor, it does look like, as in the way, in a way that the show didn't feel like comic booky. Mm-hmm. I guess if that's a, yeah, we're using that as a word.
Yeah, that's
nowadays,
fine.
I think it's pretty common.
We understand what that means.
Yeah. In the way that the show didn't feel comic booky the entire time, up until the point that he put on this like dark burgundy costume, which that was my issue with it. I was like, why don't you just make it red? You can just make it red. Like, he can just be red. Like, it doesn't have to be like dark, you know, muted burgundy, you know, maroon.
But then he'd stand out too much.
He's a guy running around kicking people in the dang face. Standing out is not an issue.
It's harder to hide in the shadow if you're in the red.
Oh, okay.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, I'm just saying. Daredevil's never had that issue in the comics, so.
Well, I'll say this. I mean, like, I thought the suit kind of looked cool, but I think the best part about the suit is the way he arrived at the suit, and it goes back to the priest again, them having that conversation about. The priest saying, and I paraphrase again, that you know, maybe God created the devil to make sure people were reminded to stay on the path of the righteous, you know, and then him kind of taking that and being birthed into the devil of Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah,
you know, him like, okay, this, like, I'm here to remind people to, when they have a choice, choose the path of the righteous. You know, a lot more fear based. You know, getting people to do good stuff, which we could have that discussion, is fear-based compliance, really compliance, or, you know, or do you have to have like a heart change through love? We've talked about that on other shows. But the actual suit itself, all that said, well, that was pretty cool. I wish I would have got more of it, you know, so I got more, a little more used to it.
I told you this, or like previously, I felt like it came about 5 episodes too late. but I also felt like the, you know, there were times where I felt like the story kind of dragged a little bit in that way too. Mm-hmm. Of like taking a little bit too long to get to the points. But you know, at the same time,
well, things definitely did.
Who's complaining, right?
Yeah, I was gonna say that things definitely did completely like change the tone and the pacing once he made that really terrible decision to try to kill Fisk.
Yeah.
And once he did that, we had a different kind of story, a different kind of focus. But the other question that we got, especially from you guys, like I said, people who have read lots of these Daredevil stories, you kind of know lots of the source material they can work with. What are some of you, or what are like one or two of you guys' predictions for season 2? Like, what are we going to see? What's going to happen to Matt Murdock next season?
Well, him and Karen Page is a definite. Like, I'm not even like joking. Like, I'm not doing that as like a pandering thing. They set it up so specifically at the end of the show. The whole season, you're like, maybe her and Foggy, and I'm excited about it because I'm like, oh, I love the idea of Karen and Foggy.
Mm-hmm.
But him and Karen are going to be a thing. That will be a source of issue, like of like stress and anxiety for Matt.
Because she's crazy.
Well, I mean, in the books,
partly because of Foggy.
Yeah, in the books, she turns crazy and like goes into an insane asylum. I don't think that that's where this is going, but I do think that it's something where like she is constantly doing things that aren't safe, like mm-hmm. that are irresponsible, like just making decisions that you're like, why did you just go and talk to that guy? Like, that was a bad idea. Like, he's a mob boss.
And there's more to her than meets the eye, right? They've already said that,
yeah, exactly.
Explicitly several times in season 1.
Yeah, yeah.
That she has some kind of a past and et cetera.
Yeah, and so I feel like that's happening for sure. And then I feel like you're going to get another major villain in congruence with Kingpin. I feel like because they've already introduced the owl, and even though did he die? Is that?
Oh, yeah.
So I'm wondering, I mean, there's not a way that they bring him back, right?
I would think that that was one of those comic book fan nods.
Okay, it was just like, hey, we know this guy exists, but he didn't make it out of the first season.
We're not doing this
So are we getting
in this show?
Are we getting? So here's the big question: are we getting Bullseye, or are we getting what's the guy with the robot legs, the giant?
Oh, what is that guy?
You know what I'm talking about? Like, Allred drew that issue, like issue 17 of this recent run. Oh my gosh! He's like a Silver Age villain with these like giant leg, like these robot legs that extend out, and
well, like Bender, you know, legs? They've hinted heavily at the hand. Yeah. They never came quite out and said them. And if you have the hand, then you're probably going to get Elektra. Also, by the time we get Daredevil season 2, we'll probably have AKA Jessica Jones and maybe even Luke Cage.
We should, I think.
Yeah, because so, aren't they saying that Defenders is not too far off, right?
Well, yeah. So they've said they're going to do AKA Jessica Jones, Luke Cage, and Iron Fist, then Defenders. But that they had not picked up Daredevil for a season 2.
At that point.
So yeah. I don't know where Daredevil is planning to be released.
Yeah, I wonder if it's going to be kind of like Iron Man 2 was out before Avengers sort of thing, where
right.
where you're going to have maybe two seasons of Daredevil, maybe two seasons of like Jessica Jones, and then one season of Luke Cage and Iron Fist and Defenders.
If that's the case, they may set up some kind, you know, we're going to see what happens with Fisk. Though actually I could imagine them leaving Fisk locked up for the majority of the season, having basically the hand come in and rise to power. And then when Fisk gets out, maybe there's some kind of big gang war that sets off Defenders. I don't know. I think we're going to get the hand. I don't want them to do Bullseye, but I don't know how long they can not do Bullseye.
Yeah, I feel like at some point you've got to do that character. Because that is what fans... like, that is what, you know... mom and pop fans of this of Daredevil know is they know right. They know Bullseye from the Ben Affleck movie, you know, and that's not, you know, I don't really want Colin Farrell back in that you know, those shoes, but you know, I would, you know, I think that you've got to do at some point that character, or at least some variation of that character. I don't think that you have to make him a guy with, you know, a giant bullseye carved into his head, but I
think it's like basically like bored, like completely insane.
Yeah, but I think
it's like a weird exhibitionist kind of. Yeah,
but I think you can kind of introduce in the same way that, like, this is one thing that I feel like Arrow and Flash do really well, is that they introduce a character without being like, and here they are in a suit. And they do have some people in suits, but for the most part, it's like, here they are, just kind of hanging around.
Chilling out,
you know. And so
when I like how they introduced Cisco in the Flash to name everyone for the audience,
yeah,
and they made it just like it, they like made it, they're like, yeah, we know it's stupid.
Yeah. So I feel like you're gonna get at some level some version of that character, some version of Elektra, mm-hmm. at some point. I mean, there's a lot of like people that I would love to see, but I just it's not gonna happen. It's too inside baseball for people to enjoy it. So.
Yeah.
Well, so we got lots of places for it to go.
Yes.
And there you have it.
Ooh, Spider-Man crossover. What
we're going to see with Matt Murdock is he has now embraced the role of the Devil of Hell's Kitchen. He is a hero. He's confident. He believes he can be, you know, lawyer by day, vigilante by night. And so that season 2 is going to be all about testing whether or not he can actually do that.
And then he's broken at the end.
Because yeah, probably more like 3/4 of the way through, but yeah.
Episode.
If we were doing a true trilogy, right?
Yeah, episode 9, he'll be down. That's when everyone dies. Episode 9. No. Okay. So, to, I guess, normally wrap up the show. What we obviously like that we like Daredevil a lot. We've used words like phenomenal, incredible. Amazing. I'm not talking with my hands right now, so I have to talk with my head.
Yeah,
you can see that.
Yep.
With your mouth.
Yeah,
he's like being very, very emotive with his face. I feel like he is an emoticon.
No, I feel like what's that one lady who's like in Glee and she was in Role Models, short hair, blonde,
Brittany Snow.
I don't think it's her name.
Sue.
I'm thinking about Sue, Jane Lynch. I'm thinking about Pitch Jane Perfect. Lynch. And that's what
I
feel Glee. Right
now. I'm feeling like Jane Lynch from Role Models right now.
Oh yeah, yeah.
She's like, you can't do that. You can't play a player. Anyway, everybody should see Role Models. It's incredible.
That's a good movie.
Yes. So we really like this show. Tangent. But was there anything that you didn't like? And you didn't call dibs on the not likes, Griffin. So JR, you still get to do you still get to do not likes first.
I get to go first on the likes too, but I already called dibs.
Honestly, no. I mean, there was not for the first season of a show, for such a gamble as, you know, basically putting the MCU on the small screen, mm-hmm. not S.H.I.E.L.D., you know, for all of those kinds of things, for taking a property that in the vast majority of the public consciousness has a very bad taste, right? I mean, yeah. Like, all of those things, I don't think they could have done it a lot better. I would have liked to have seen more Rosario Dawson, but, you know, I what they did with her character made sense.
Yeah.
No, it was great.
You would say that.
And I will say this, since we skipped favorites, or are we going
to? No, we're going to.
Okay, sorry. I'll wait.
You just can't go first, apparently.
Yeah. Well, no, you can go first. Like I said, it's just.
No, I have a different thing.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I'm glad you thought of that. Things I didn't like. You know, I hate it whenever, like, some guy is really nice to a girl. and then she ends up picking, like, the better looking of the two of them. And then it's like, and that's just how the story goes. Because I feel like it's this thing where, you know, clearly Foggy is in love with Karen Page, and then why does he just gets back together with this, like, hussy? What is up with that? No one wants her in the show. I don't want to see her in second season.
It's so we can we don't feel completely empathetic towards Foggy, because up until that point you're like, come on, Foggy's the nice guy.
But he
guy.
Just, like, walks away from Karen. He just forgets about it. He, like, they don't even, like, acknowledge, like, what happened that made him be like, Karen no more. He's just like, man, she wants me back, so I'm going back. I guess that's enough.
Well, I think it's...
Are they back, though? Or are they just kind of, like, booty calls?
Were they just hooking up? I mean, I felt like at the end of the show, doesn't he, like, leave them to go hang out with her?
She was talking about it... as if it was like they were back together.
Yeah, I feel like he was like leaving them to go be with her, like to go see her.
Yeah.
Which seems like something someone who's dating someone or in a serious relationship heading towards marriage would do.
Yeah. So actually, I think that's a very interesting thing. And obviously, it would be way too long of a tangent, but there's a conversation to have there where if, you know, Karen would have gone and like slept with Matt when Foggy was still into her, there would be certain things that we thought about Karen and her character.
Yes.
But if Foggy had been like, hey, it's not completely working with Karen yet, so I'm going to go back and I'm going to, you know, see this, what booty call.
They're just making it okay that Karen and
Matt
are going to get together. Yeah. And they had to have, like, she had to have some, like, Foggy had to have a love interest.
Yeah. Well, Foggy had to have something that the audience, I think, could identify with that says he is no longer the... not to blame in this situation. He is being a little man whorish as well, and we're gonna call him on it. So
Foggy,
old Foggy.
Are we slut shaming Foggy?
I think we're trying to.
Okay.
I just want to make. Well, actually, I don't want to slut shame Foggy. I want to make sure if there's anyone out there who thinks that we should. It's not really necessarily slut shaming Karen. It's. Like dissing her, because, you know, there's that idea.
Feel like she did anything wrong.
Yeah, but if she would have,
I mean, she murdered that dude.
Well,
look, I'm talking about in the sense of
she
like
she should have just
mattered.
Rolled over and taken it.
She should just let herself get shot.
She should have just let herself get killed. That was the better decision. Was for her to just
of the only two that were available to her.
Yeah.
Just kidding, Karen Page. You shot that dude. And he deserved it.
Oh man, you totally showed him a better way. He really rethought his decisions now.
Well, he'll never leave a loaded gun on the table again, that's for sure.
Or anything else ever.
Except his brains.
Just his brains. But yeah, I mean, I don't feel like there's any reason to be upset with Karen for the way that she handled that relationship. She wasn't into Foggy, rightfully so.
But she kind of got into Foggy a little
bit. She
kind
of, but not enough, because there was always that Matt Murdock in the background. Swooning that smile.
Yeah, not having any chemistry with her.
You don't like it when the attractive guy gets the girl.
Yeah,
but Matt Murdock, man.
I just didn't feel like they had any chemistry at all. So the fact that they're trying to build towards this didn't work for me.
I think you're just gonna have that moment at the very end where he's like, "I'm over all like my internal stuff of like trying to decide whether I'm like the devil or not. Mm-hmm. Now I know what I am. Yo, girl."
Well, that's the thing that's gonna make me upset at Matt, because I'm just like, if the Karen Page thing starts to go in that direction, I was like, one, you guys have zero chemistry. You have almost nothing in common. She makes terrible decisions, and you do too, so this isn't helping. And you've already got someone that you're really into and you have chemistry with, so why would you not try to pursue that with everything that you have? Anyway, so love life. I like, this is what we're getting caught up on. You know,
we're getting like really
a bunch of dudes being like, man, the love story in this, it's really disappointing.
It's really a big letdown.
That's right. We're breaking stereotypes.
Yep.
We have hearts.
All right.
Actually, the only thing that really bothered me, just Karen Page's decisions. I feel like, you know how they, in lots of, especially TV shows, they always have the crazy maker.
Yes.
Like, if it wasn't for this person, everything probably would have worked out fine in two episodes. I feel like Karen Page is like, everything would have worked out, well, maybe like in five episodes. Like, Matt Murdock could have probably just cleaned up the city, you know?
Yeah.
Really?
Not really, but you know, like, there's always the crazy maker. Like, there's someone who comes in and does the wrong thing to make things worse than they already could have been. You know? Like, thanks, Karen, because you were nosy and didn't listen to anyone and were basically selfish, you got Ben killed. Good job.
Oh, okay, man. I keep forgetting that Ben got killed.
No, Ben was out, and she was like, "Hey, Ben, I just wanted to do something nice for your wife. You want to go up and look at this thing? Oh, I didn't even know. Whoops!" And then Ben was back in.
Ben's curiosity killed that cat. Don't put that on camera.
Super sad that Ben's not going to be around for the second season, though. He's always.
Can we talk about? That's a great example of how I, as a comic book reader, like when Fisk is in his apartment, I was like, well, I don't know how this is going to end, but definitely Ben's not going to die. Yeah. And I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. I very much felt the same way where I was like, Ben's going to make it out of this fine. He's got to be the person who writes Daredevil's memoir. Like, I mean, he's going to be the person who writes the biography of like Matt Murdock at some point.
At the end of season six, he just kind of closes the book. And that was my time.
Yeah. I mean, like, literally that's Ben Urich. And I don't know why. Yeah. Now you're going to get, like, what is it going to be? Jimmy Olsen come to town? Oh, sorry, wrong universe. That would be great, though. Gosh, what if there was a Jimmy Olsen character?
And then we changed his gender and race just to prove how progressive we were. Wouldn't that be great?
Wait, are you saying Karen Page is Jimmy Olsen?
Maybe.
No, I'm saying like, we get a new writer. We get a new journalist on the show.
No, I know what you're saying, Griffin.
Oh,
I
think you're listening to him. Never mind. Got it.
No. I'm saying... No, I'm just clarifying Mikey's speculations.
No,
that in the end it was all Jimmy Olsen.
Ooh, because transgender. She's talked about having the stuff. Like, she's got the itch. She's got the ability. That's you. Oh man, you just caught it there. You
heard it here first, folks. Real world.
You heard it here first. Thank you for tuning in. That's all we have for you.
Write it down.
Write it down.
Oh, okay. Favorite moment. JR, you can go first. You just can't have one particular moment.
So there was a really great hallway scene that you've probably heard a lot about, but I'm going to be honest with you. Like, everyone talks about that almost like that's the only thing they watched in the show. And I like to go a little deeper. No, on all seriousness, all of the choreography was phenomenal. Like, the very first fight on the docks, like the, this is not Batman Begins, but it totally is scene. My jaw was on the floor, and like every single fight, my jaw was on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I wish that his fight with the ninja had not been cut up over the series of a whole episode.
Yeah,
because I totally wanted to see that whole fight. Like, in if anyone makes a super cut of that,
surely someone like has.
Just amazing. Huh. And then the other thing that I absolutely loved was how they handled Fisk's character. Like, that we don't even meet him till episode three, that for episode three and most of four, you actually like him. You're like, man, this guy, I don't know. And then at the end of four is when he decapitates that dude with a car door. And like, just when the way his violence explodes out of him, it was so terrifying. and it worked for me really well. Like, I totally bought him as a great, great, great villain. So
I remember during that episode when he bashes the guy's head in, at some point I leaned over to Laura and I said, this is a really interesting direction they're going with Fisk, or with Kingpin. From what I remember, like, he's a huge, like, imposing and very strong guy. I mean, like, I'm not sure how they're going to set up him, like, basically punching the Daredevil into two pieces, like, at the rate they're going. And then at the end of the episode, we got that, and I was like, well, okay.
Okay.
No more solved it. Solved it.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Phenomenal.
So that was it. Good. That was it for me, those two things, the choreography and the and Fisk were just great.
That's basically phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think essentially amazing.
Essentially amazing.
Yeah.
Basically phenomenal.
Yeah.
Griffin, was there anything that you liked about the series? I hate everybody.
The hallway scene, that's all. Thanks. Thanks for asking.
Was there, what the scene where
No,
where
you didn't get to see it. They didn't let you see it. They didn't let you see it. Yeah, yeah.
It was a separate one.
Yeah, yeah. It was an extended edition for, like, North Carolina residents only. That's why you didn't hear about it. Like, you may have like read about it. There was like some New Yorker article about it or something like that, and people were talking about it. But they like came to North Carolina, got to watch it, and then flew back. Yeah, yeah. But you gotta. Yeah, it's not
at netflix.com/NC.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. But even then, you have to like have a login that's specific to North. It's
from
weird.
North Carolina.
Oh, yeah, it's terrible. Weird. You can. Yeah, I don't know.
It's,
so yeah,
it's probably not that worth it.
There was a scene, if you're in North Carolina, you've seen it. They're in a hallway fighting. It's pretty cool.
I actually, as soon as I saw that scene, I was like, man, one shot scene that's this long. I can't wait to talk to Griffin about this scene, because he's gonna be as excited about this as he was for that True Detective scene.
Ooh, this is the one shot True Detective scene. Oh man.
It was great.
And I mean, it's made me like fall in love with that style. Like, mm-hmm. the people who were able to do that. Birdman is so cool because mm-hmm. of there's so many of those long shots. But yeah.
Gotcha.
Hallway scene.
So I also picked, I mean, like, the moment, you know, like the moment that I realized, like, this is going to just keep getting better was the hallway, that hallway fight. And especially because it's not just the story that's interesting at that point, it's the fact that you have people who were very skilled and committed to this to make a quality production. They're not just like, yeah, we're throwing this on Netflix. It's going to have MCU stamped on it. People are going to watch it. They were like, look, we're going for something that has a definite style and a definite feel, and we're going to sell out to make that happen. And then from then on, I was on board with it. And I would say the thing that had me probably on the edge of my seat more than anything else was, I think when he was in the warehouse with that Russian, and they're kind
of
like,
police have it surrounded.
Yeah, and he kind of has to keep bringing the Russian back to life.
Yeah.
And then they crash through the floor, and then they're in the basement, and then he's having to like convince the Russian that, like, he's like, there's a reason you're alive right now. I need information. Don't die until you tell me this.
Yeah.
And then he still kind of keeps beating up Daredevil. I just, that whole piece, not knowing what Fisk was going to do in that situation, not knowing what the dirty cops were going to do, not knowing what Ben was going to do, you know, and that was put against having Karen and Foggy, I think, with over at the Tenet building, I believe. So, I mean, there was just so much going on right then, and they kept coming back to this him and the Russian thing. It was quite intense. And I just thought it was great. I just thought it was really great.
Yeah.
Well, all right, so any final thoughts? I mean, like I said, obviously we enjoy it. JR, anything else that you wanted to commend to people about it?
I mean, I don't know what else we could say. If you aren't already interested in this show, I'm not sure how you made it this far in the podcast.
Yeah. You're probably really bored by now.
I mean, other than our charm and banter,
yeah,
obviously.
Witty banter.
Witty banter. Why are you saying that so weird?
Why am I saying what way? Well, I'll say this. So,
wait, witty doesn't even have an H in it.
What do you mean? I did have some questions going into Daredevil. I was like, can Marvel translate their universe to the small screen. Because I'd seen S.H.I.E.L.D. and I said, obviously they can't. Because I know, I mean, I know some people really like S.H.I.E.L.D. for whatever reason, but if it wasn't tied to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there would be very little reason to watch it. Peggy Carter was better, but mostly because we were comparing it to S.H.I.E.L.D. And then this came along, and I said, okay, you win.
Okay, do you think that's because they don't have the constraints of network television?
Yes.
I feel like it really, really helps.
Because this show, I mean, whenever I...
Should I say some other obvious stuff for you guys to agree with?
Yes, I want you to do that.
Can you... I mean, the thing that I kept telling people as they asked me, like, what do you think about it? I was like, show's a lot darker than I thought the Marvel, like...
Universe could be.
Like, what I thought Marvel was willing to go. Like, where I thought they were willing to go with the TV show. You know, and I figured, like, you know, when you say we're going to do a Jessica Jones television show, I'm like, well, there've only been really two comic book series. You have Alias and The Pulse. And The Pulse was terrible, and Alias was amazing. So they're probably going to go with Alias. You know, the very dark, very, like, scary Jessica Jones who's like, I will kill you if you come near my child.
Right.
I will straight up end your life.
Well, so what I like, what it's done is it's taken that DC torch, or that I don't know, the shining yellow ball that DC kind of was known for. Because before, we've already talked about this a little bit, when someone would say, oh, what's the difference between like kind of like the DC films and what's the difference between the Marvel? Oh, Marvel's all like explosions and joking around and not too serious and throwaway villains and stuff like that. But DC is dark and brooding, and it's totally a different feel. And Marvel was like, that's not going to be the thing that separates us anymore. We're going to go back to DC is not giving us lots of character depth, and Marvel is focusing on the humanity of their heroes.
Yes.
And Marvel doubled down on that and proved that they could do something dark. And in and of, like, I was impressed. I was very impressed, and now I know they can do it. And kind of like you're saying, JR, that different format, I think that made almost all the difference in the world. Because much like Griffin has said, what we get with like Arrow and Flash is almost like a villain of the week.
And Smallville ideology there.
Yeah, I mean,
I think I'm just going to defend those two shows for a minute.
I get that they're better than Smallville, but not by much.
Okay. I disagree. I could not stand Smallville, and I love Arrow and the Flash.
Yeah, well.
I'm about to bail on Arrow.
That show.
You heard season 4 is going to be better. That's what they said.
if they knew a way to make it better, why didn't they make it better? Like that.
They had to get through. Man, they had to go to some dark places, all right? When you start a season by killing a main character, got to go dark.
Spoilers, jeez.
He said a main character. There's so
many. Yeah, there's only 17 on Arrow, so yeah. Guess gosh. Which one might die.
Oh, I mean, it's never the right one because Laurel is always alive. Why is Laurel still alive?
I know, right?
Gosh.
Because Black Canary, man, you need her.
She's the worst. Actually, no, I'm just kidding. She's not the worst because I watch Flash, and whatever Flash's girlfriend, not girlfriend name is, she's the worst. Anyway. Okay, so I mean, so defend it. Like, what is it? Just because is the going to dark places the defense?
What do you mean?
Well, you said you were going to defend Arrow and Flash.
Oh no, I think given their constraints, which is that they're on the CW, mm-hmm. they do a much better job of being enjoyable than like S.H.I.E.L.D. does. Now, granted, I haven't seen S.H.I.E.L.D. since the middle of the first season. I've heard it's gotten a lot better, but. I consistently have a great time when we watch The Flash, and I think they balance the freak of the week stuff with the overarching story stuff really well, because at the end of the day, that's the limit of the network television, right? Mm-hmm. They can't do a 13-hour show,
yeah,
a movie, right? Which Netflix can, and that's okay.
Lost.
Well, Lost was terrible. So
I'm just saying. First off, no, it wasn't. You may not have liked it. That show was not terrible.
Okay.
Says the guy who has watched every episode of Flash and Green Arrow. You can't talk about how Lost is terrible.
Well, comparatively. So, but I think that goes back to what JR is saying. So, I would say that if maybe Daredevil is your first foray into comic book television,
superheroes on TV.
Yeah, superheroes on TV. Then I don't necessarily think Flash and Arrow would be a waste of your time. You just have to really understand what you're getting into.
Yes.
And the constraints. I mean, both those shows are way better than they should be for being on the CW.
Yes.
That said, they're still on the CW, and there's still too much things that don't matter.
All these things are true.
They're
a lot of fun.
I would say the other thing is the fact that because they're on like network television, I don't think superhero stories tend to make very good 23 episode seasons.
Accurate.
That's just a really, really long time.
Can I tell you an insight I read on the internet somewhere and can't remember well enough to attribute?
Yes, that means we don't have to because we don't remember.
That's right.
Someone observed that comic books are always telling act two of a story. Which is the part of the story where it's the introduction is the, you know, and Griffin, this goes back to what you were saying that Wade does so well, right? You don't get the how they got their powers, mm-hmm. who they are, all that's been established, and you're never going to get the end of the story, ever. In fact, Marvel has made a nice little sort of niche market of having Wolverine, the end, Hulk, the end, Spider-Man, the end, that actually does tell the end of their story.
You should read Daredevil End of Days. It's really good.
Yeah.
If you want to hear, like, what... Yeah. It's Ben Urich writing Daredevil's biography. It's fantastic. Not even kidding. It's amazing.
Right, but because obviously these books are sort of designed to be indefinite.
They're soap operas. Yeah, they have to go on forever.
Never end.
Yeah.
They always are only telling act two of the story. And that's what I think is really interesting about... Yeah, it works for 13 episodes. You can't do that for 23. And that's why you get the Freak of the Week stuff. That's mm-hmm. why you get the, you know, mm-hmm. it kind of sagged after the mid-season finale, blah, blah, like all that stuff, right? It's because you can't tell act two for 25 hours. Like, no one's going to sit through it.
Well, except for JR, who is definitely sitting
through. I entirely enjoy it knowing exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Right? It's like when I eat candy bars. I know they're not good for me, but they're delicious.
But you're just not yourself if you don't have a Snickers. So
Real-world theology brought to you by Snickers.
That's right. Hey, if Snickers wants to sponsor the show, that would be the greatest thing.
Why would they do that when you're giving them free advertising?
I don't know. Gosh, darn you, Snickers. Money. Foil again. They're like my foil. You know, we grew up very similar.
We have the same goal. You know? Which is delicious candy bars in your mouth.
I have a t-shirt that says that. Mikey Fissel is about delicious candy bars in your mouth.
No, in your mouth.
Well, you know, that's what I thought. I thought it was your mouth, but it's really your mouth.
Yeah, it's your mouth.
So.
All right.
Snickers
that's the
and
show. Thanks for checking it out. All right, we'll see you next week.
All right, JR, how can people get a hold of you, man?
I'm on Twitter and Facebook at JR Forresteros. I blog at NorvalRogers.com, which is Shaggy's real name from Scooby-Doo, so if you can't figure out how to spell it, just Google that. And I have like 15 other podcasts that I'm on. They're all at Norval. So it's really only four, but...
It's pretty...
Brag much.
All right, Griffin.
I mean, I started them all, so I don't feel like that's bragging.
That's true. No.
I'm just saying facts.
I'm just stating obvious here.
I just record myself talking and put it on the
internet. I do it quite a bit. You can find me at griffinkale.com as well as Twitter, griffin_kale. And there's gonna be other stuff, but like, it's so
not
hard.
Yet. Not yet.
It's all right. I can't talk about it.
That's
all
right.
And that sucks. But hey, you know, very soon, like, know that like what I'm talking about right now, content is already produced for, which is great. Like, once I can tell you about it.
So follow you at Griffin Kale.
You'll have, if you follow me there, like, once I can tell you about it, there will be, like, a lot of stuff to look at, which is awesome, which I'm really excited about. So, keep following along, and I will be telling you very soon, hopefully.
Cool. Follow me, Fizzification. Follow the show, Real World Theology. iTunes.
R-E-E-L.
You can go to the website, which is realworldtheology.com. R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. All that stuff I already said. iTunes, Stitcher. Leave us reviews. That's awesome. Thank you, guys. Thank you, listeners, for sticking with us for a long show.
Because
it's a TV episode.
A lot of hands
right now. I'm basically phenomenally, amazingly, essentially using my hands right now.
Yeah, keep it up.
So, I mean, you only had two choices.
That's right.
To listen to this episode or murder us to death.
That's right. It's very binary. but it's redemptive listening.
Yeah.
You know? Some people think that redemptive listening is just a myth, but I tell you, redemptive listening is a thing. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful.
And entertainment is not mindless.
Bye-bye.
Never
mindless. Bye, guys. Never mindless. Ever. Not ever. Once. Yeah. Not once has it ever been mindless.
Especially not for the past 2 hours.
Yeah, nope. Yep. You can either be mindless or kill us.
This is where we fade out.
Bye, guys.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
That's it. I knew I had to get him out of the way before we started. I had to get the jelly beans out of the bag.
Oh, wait. We haven't started? I thought we started like...
we started?
I don't know.
Sorry.
It really depends.
Well, edit out that crumpling, then. It won't happen.
No, leave it in.
Actually, that'll be the thing at the end. It'll just be like JR crumpling on things.
It'll just be like a loop of that.